We're joined on the phone right now by Dr. Stephen Zunes. He is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, where he has taught since 1995. He serves as an advisory committee member and Middle East editor for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project, and as an associate editor of Peace Review. Professor Zunes is the author of scores of articles for scholarly and general readership on Middle Eastern politics, U.S. foreign policy, international terrorism, social movements, and human rights. He is the principal editor of Nonviolent Social Movements and the author of the highly acclaimed Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and the forthcoming Western Sahara Nationalism and Conflict in Northwest Africa. Dr. Zunes has made frequent trips to the Middle East and other conflict regions where he has met with top government officials, academics, journalists, and opposition leaders. And I'm very pleased to have you with me today, Stephen, to discuss the current situation with Israel and Palestine peace negotiations. Hello.
Hi. It's been a while. Good to be back.
Thanks for taking the time today. So maybe we can start off, if you can help bring me and my listeners up to date on the current situation with peace negotiations between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. I heard a number of different things, starting with the Middle East Peace Summit in Annapolis in November. I heard recently that Abbas is threatening to pull out of peace negotiations. Also heard that Olmert had refused his previous demands that Israel stop settlement building, and that Bush, although he's speaking about ending the occupation, he is saying the occupation has to end, and at the same time, he's not backing Abbas up on his demands that settlement building stop. So what is the current situation? Maybe you can bring us up to date.
Well, basically, the Prime Minister of Israel, with the support of President Bush, is ready to negotiate the establishment of some kind of a Palestinian entity, even an independent state, but that it would be only as much land as Israel is inclined to provide them, and which would be presumably the majority of the West Bank, but it would be divided up in a whole series of non-contiguous cantons, and the remainder being incorporated into Israel. And so basically the expanding settlements are in the part that Prime Minister Olmert sees as being part of Israel, and Bush supports him on this, so he's not complaining, even though the roadmap and several other agreements made previously by the Israeli government obliged them to stop expanding settlements, and as a matter of fact, no less than four UN Security Council resolutions call on them to withdraw from every single settlement they have built since they began their occupation in 1967 in accordance with the Fourth Geneva Convention. So basically we have yet another situation, as we've seen throughout the so-called peace process, where the U.S. is backing the more powerful of the two parties, and the Palestinians see more and more of their land being confiscated and colonized.
You wrote in an article, and I want to mention to folks that if you'd like to read Stephen's articles, they're now in one place at his own website now, stephenzunes.org. In late November, you wrote an article called Broken Peace Process. You've written a couple since, one in December and one this month on January 16th. But in this piece called Broken Peace Process, one of the things you say is that unless Israel and the U.S. are willing to address the core issues, boundaries that would ensure a viable contiguous Palestinian state, withdrawal of troops and settlers from the West Bank, except perhaps for some along the border in exchange for an equal amount of Israeli land, and a just resolution of the refugee problem, the conference will amount to little more than a photo op. Is that ultimately what the peace summit in Annapolis amounted to, in your view?
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. I mean, it was nice. It's always nice for people to sit down and talk with each other, and the fact that the vast majority of Arab states showed up for that, it underscored what they've been saying for some years now, that they are willing to recognize Israel and provide security guarantees and all that in exchange for Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. But in terms of any anything that's going to move in that direction, not much at all. I mean, but part of the problem is that the U.S. attitude has been, oh, let the two parties work it out among themselves, you know, which, you know, is fine in principle, except when you consider the gross asymmetry in power between the Palestinians under occupation and the Israeli occupiers, and as well as the unfortunate reality that the United States is simultaneously the sole international mediator of the conflict. He's pretty much frozen out the other three members of the so-called quartet of the United Nations, Russia, and the European Union. But we also are the principal backer of one of the two parties, and that there's an inherent contradiction there that, you know, makes it pretty pretty clear that things aren't going to move forward unless the United States is willing to pressure Israel to live up to its international legal obligations.
What do you think is behind Bush's comments about how the occupation has to come to an end? I recently had my sister say to me, I heard that he made these statements, and do you think anything's going to change? This is really hopeful. And I said, well, it kind of seems to me like he's leaving office soon, and he wants to have, you know, a kind of, you know, handshake moment like Clinton. And I just... what do you think is behind these comments? Do you think there's any substance to it?
Not really. It is a stronger language than he has used, I think, before. But and he was about to leave for all these Arab countries who have been giving him a lot of pressure on this. But he really hasn't demonstrated any real effort to bring it into the occupation. After all, the United States provides the financial support for the occupation, the military support for the occupation, as well as the diplomatic cover for the occupation. The other problem is that he did not define what he considered to be occupied territory. That is to say that, that given that he appears to be willing to accept Israel annexation of these broad swaths of West Bank territory, he's clearly saying that, well, some of the occupation should end, but the rest of it Israel can annex, and then it won't be an occupation either because it will be then legally part of Israel. In fact, he specifically said that Palestine should not expect Israel to withdraw to its internationally recognized borders pre-June 67, and the Palestinians had to accept the new demographic realities, namely these thousands of Israeli colonists who have seized and built these settlements on occupied Palestinian land in defiance of international humanitarian law and a series of UN Security Council resolutions.
What about Mahmoud Abbas? He's said he may drop out of negotiations. What's currently the situation with that?
Well, I mean, obviously the Palestinians are getting very frustrated, and indeed you can trace the rise of Hamas as a direct reflection of Palestinian frustrations, that the more moderate approach that Abbas and the Fatah movement has taken in recent years of relying on U.S.-led negotiations haven't made things any better. In fact, they've gotten worse. So they've seen more and more of their land confiscated by Israeli occupation forces, and so a lot of Palestinians figure, hey, the hell with moderation. It's not getting us anywhere. Maybe we need to support these hardline militants. And so it's So Abbas, basically has to at least act like he's, being tough and saying, "Oh, this is unacceptable. This keeps going. I'll break off negotiations." But again, what good will that do? The U.S. will, put on the squeeze and force him back or try to make him look at the spoiler. See, he's not interested in peace. He's not willing to negotiate. Whatever. So he's really between a rock and a hard place. There's not a whole lot of options he has at this point.
What about his popularity with the Palestinian people? Is it pretty low?
Yes, though it's higher than Hamas. Most Palestinians are pretty frustrated with their leadership across the board, because, in part because there's been enormous amount of corruption and and not very particularly good governance for the urban areas of the West Bank, which are which Fatah controls as part of the Palestine Authority, but also that there again the peace process really hasn't moved things forward at all.
You say that Abbas is between a rock and a hard place. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? If he backs out, what's the consequences? And if he stays in, what's the consequences? You say
he backs out, he's going to be seen as a spoiler. There's going to be pressure from Congress and the Bush administration around cutting off any kind of foreign assistance, which keeps his government going. And because the Israelis have hundreds and hundreds of roadblocks and control all the border crossings to Jordan or wherever, they... their economy is in shambles, so they live off of foreign aid. And of course, without any kind of negotiations, it gives an Israel excuse to colonize and take over even more land. If they do take part in the peace process, it gives a sense that that things are moving forward. But Israel can keep on stalling, refusing to make concessions. And there's not much hope in the future because all three of the leading Democratic contenders for president, along with the leading Republican contenders for president, essentially take the same position as President Bush, that they support the Israeli position, that they have a right to continue this expansion of their settlements. And that the Palestinians bear the onus of responsibility in terms of moving the peace process forward.
What kind of validity does this quote-unquote peace process have in the eyes of the world right now? My understanding of this Annapolis Peace Summit and Middle East Peace Summit was that it was kind of picking up where the roadmap left off. And basically at this point, you wrote in one of your articles, The Failure of Annapolis, that according to the text of the Annapolis Agreement, quote, implementation of the future peace treaty will be subject to the implementation of the roadmap, quote, as judged by the United States.
Yes.
And then you go on to say that the United States will monitor and judge the, well, Bush stated this, that the United States will monitor and judge the fulfillment of the commitment of both sides of the roadmap. What kind of validity does this peace process have in your view, and also in the eyes of the world, when it's basically run by the U.S.?
Less and less so. I mean, the roadmap was an attempt for other international actors to be involved, in the, but the U.S. insisted, and these other actors caved in, that previous U.N. Security Council resolutions and international humanitarian law and human rights would not be part of the process. And it was supposed to be a performance-based roadmap, based on both sides cooperating. But the U.S. position has been that the Palestinians have to live up to all their obligations first. So, in other words, the Palestinians are responsible for preventing further preventing any violence against Israel. So, when radical Islamists in Gaza, which is out of control, was not even controlled by Abbas's Palestine Authority, lobbed these rockets into a nearby Israeli town. That gives the Israelis the right to not live up to any of their obligations under the first phase of the roadmap, such as ending the expansion of settlements. And so again, this is not how the rest of the international community interpreted it. This is how the United States is interpreting it. And so the international community is getting more and more frustrated at the U.S. Refusing U.S. failure to include them in a substantive way and to move the peace process forward. In fact, it was very revealing when President Bush. In response to a reporter's question, explicitly said that the United Nations resolutions are things of the past. We need to look at the future, basically saying Israel had no obligation to live up to its international legal obligations. Again, this is the same administration that insists on sanctions and even war against other countries that violate UN Security Council resolutions, but if it's an ally like Israel, our position is they don't have to abide by them. And of course, and he basically justified it because the UN process hasn't helped. And the reason the UN hasn't helped is the United States has blocked enforcement of these resolutions. Otherwise, it would have helped. I mean, United States. I mean, if the United States had not vetoed these resolutions, Israel and had not blocked the enforcement of other resolutions which had passed, Israel would be required to withdraw from these illegal settlements and their accept their obligation to leave the occupied territories in return for security guarantees, as the as these UN resolutions have called for.
I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunes. He is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and author of the highly acclaimed Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. His website, stephenzunes.org, if you want to read his articles and get more information about him. We're talking about the current peace situation with the peace negotiations between Israeli and Palestinian leaders. In a recent article that you wrote on January 16th, titled Still No Peace, you say that the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian impasse comes down to four major unresolved issues. Can you talk about what those four main unresolved issues are, as well as what the positions are of Israel and the Israeli leaders and the Palestinian leaders and the U.S.?
Well, the first of all, of course, is the settlement. The Fourth Geneva Conventions make it illegal for any occupying power to move civilians on to territories seized by military force. The United States basically takes the position that Israel can continue its colonization of occupied lands in the West Bank, encouraging to withdraw from a few of these isolated settlements, which are mostly mobile homes that are that are perched on a hilltop, two or three of them with an Israeli flag on the top. And the Israeli government has moved a few of these, though most of them still remain. But beyond that, the large settlements, the ones that really are of any significance, those aren't. The U.S. doesn't think that Israel needs to move those, and so it's essentially the same as the Israeli position. And the Palestinians, of course, insist that Israel abide by its international legal obligations. The big problem is that without the United States backing the Palestinians on this, even though in terms of international law, the Palestinians are right, there's very little chance this happens. Now, the Palestinians have made a major concession in that they say that Israel can keep most of the settlements, but only the ones right along the border in return for an equivalent amount of Palestinian land. But even this compromise isn't enough for Israel or the United States.
An equivalent amount of Israeli land.
Right.
Exchange. Okay.
Exactly.
You said Palestinian. So, so that's one issue, is the settlements. And there's three other main issues, you say, one
yes,
of which...
There's the extent of the Israeli withdrawal. UN Security Council Resolution 242-338, which has long been the base of the peace and is based explicitly on the long-standing international principle that no country can expand its territory by force, calls for Israel-Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories in return for security guarantees. Interestingly, there's a difference between the French and the English version. Those are the two official languages of the resolution. The French version has a definite article, and the U.S. one doesn't. So Israel says, "Well, we've already withdrawn from some occupied territories, like the Sinai Peninsula, so we don't have to withdraw from any more." But in reality, according to the British and American ambassadors who wrote that resolution, they were talking about, at most, very minor and reciprocal border adjustments, nothing substantive at all. And so, again, the United States' position is that Israel can hold on to much broader swaths of territory than that. And the Palestinians, of course, are saying, look, we already gave up 78% of historic Palestine when in the Oslo Accords. We're just asking for 22% of our homeland. We cannot settle for anything less. And the Israeli and U.S. position is you're going to have to settle for less.
And then there's the issue of Jerusalem.
Yeah, Jerusalem, of course, is not only of religious significance, but you know, it's the you know, for the Palestinians, it's also their largest city, their you know, commercial and political and educational center, and most people. And the original idea way back in 1947 was to have it as an international city, and it was divided Berlin style between Jordan and Israel for the first 19 years after the creation of Israel. And it's been under Israeli occupation ever since. Israel's unlike most of the West Bank, has formally annexed all of Greater East Jerusalem, including large rural areas to the west and north as well, and incorporated into the city. What the Palestinians realize it's unrealistic to go back to the 67 borders, but at least they would like to control the Arab neighborhoods and the Muslim holy places and have it as a capital of co-capital, basically, of the Palestinian state as well as Israel. Israel, however, refuses to abide by this and insists it's always going to be forever unified Israel. The U.S. Congress passed a resolution this past summer by an overwhelming bipartisan majority that essentially said the same thing, seeing it as an Israeli city only. So, you know, it's going to be very hard to imagine any kind of peace settlement that doesn't include Jerusalem as a co-capital.
I'm sorry, could you say that again? Who voted that it should remain in Israel?
U.S. Congress.
I see.
It was a non-binding resolution, but it showed there was overwhelming support for Jerusalem to be exclusively under Israeli sovereignty.
What is the situation currently with Jerusalem? I know it's very complicated.
Yeah, it's fully annexed into Israel. So it's not, the Israelis don't even see it as occupied territory, though the rest of the international community, with the exception of the United States, does recognize it as occupied territory.
And you're saying that under any peace agreement, it would have to be co-capital, where
yes,
Palestinians...
Yes, at least the Arab neighborhoods and Muslim holy places under Palestinian sovereignty, and the Jewish neighborhoods, both in West Jerusalem, which was the Israeli half prior to 67, as well as the settlements in parts of East Jerusalem, would presumably be incorporated into Israel as well.
It seems to me that there's been so much settlement building in East Jerusalem that I don't know how Palestinians would have much for their capital.
Well, actually, most of the older neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, which, you know, number a good 150,000, 200,000, are still Palestinian. And though Israel has surrounded much of it with rings of these illegal Jewish settlements, you know, there is enough access, if you will, that it could indeed be incorporated. The Palestinian populated segments could be incorporated into the West Bank.
But you're saying it won't happen unless
the United States changes its position and pushes Israel to allow the Palestinians to control Palestinian populated segments. In fact, there have been no less than a dozen UN Security Council resolutions declaring Israel's annexation null and void, and calling on Israel to cease from any action that would unilaterally change the status of East Jerusalem. Again, this is another area where Israel's clearly in violation of international law, but the United States is nevertheless backing Israel.
So the four major unresolved issues that you mentioned are settlements, Israeli withdrawal at Jerusalem, and also refugees. Can you talk just a little bit about refugees, and then I'll have a final question for
sure.
You.
Sure. During the war of between 1947 and 1949, Israel and taking over 78% of Palestine through a combination of people just fleeing the fighting, and in some cases an explicit policy of ethnic cleansing, removed over 700,000 Palestinians from lands they'd lived on for many centuries. The surviving refugees and their descendants number close to 4 million now. Now, the international law says that everybody has a right to leave or return to their country of origin. So technically speaking, Israel's obliged to let all these people come back. I mean, but when they kicked them out, back in 1948-49, they basically made that impossible. The Israelis, of course, are concerned because at this point, if all the Palestinian refugees came back, there'd be more Palestinians than Israelis in Israel, and it would no longer be a Jewish state. And there's also some debate even among people involved in international law that, that the right of return was a principle that, based on the assumption that refugee situations only last a few weeks or months, or at most a few years, not several generations. So the Palestinians are holding on to this demand of the right of return, but by most accounts as a bargaining chip, because in order to get Israel to compromise on these other issues, with the hope that Israel would compensate Israel and the international community, would help resettle these refugees in the new Palestinian state, the 22% left of Palestine, or in the various Arab countries where most of the refugees live in refugee camps currently, but only allow them to settle as permanent citizens and the like. The U.S. position has been very clear that the Palestinians do not have a right of return. The Palestinians should unilaterally renounce this right of return, and not even use it as a bargaining chip, much less as something which, arguably they have the legal right to demand. So yet another example of where the U.S. has taken the Israeli position very strongly and is opposing the Palestinian position. And what's striking about all these, and this is something that very few Americans recognize, is that on virtually on all these outstanding issues, really, the Palestinian position is far closer to the international, the consensus of international law, far closer to the position of virtually all the countries of the world, including America's European allies. Far closer, to the position of Israeli peace activists and other Israeli progressives than is the position of the United States and Israel. So, in other words, the Israeli government, the U.S. government, including Democratic leaders in Congress, take positions that are well off the chart of the broad international consensus about resolution. And so it makes it particularly ironic that the United States is the self-described chief mediator of the conflict. And you have, people like Hillary Clinton going around saying, the Palestinians must learn to compromise, and it's their fault that the peace process isn't moving forward, and da-da-da-da-da.
I just have one final question for you, Stephen, and we just have a couple minutes left to wrap it up. Have the current peace negotiations going on between the Palestinian-Israeli leadership and the U.S., have they brought any of these issues any closer to being resolved? And if not, what would need to change for that to happen?
Things haven't moved. The Palestinians feel like they've given all they could give, again, except for giving up the right of return, and they're not willing to give that up unilaterally, only if Israel is, willing to withdraw from the occupied territories and share Jerusalem and the like. So there's really not much hope at all that things are going to progress, unless the United States is willing to pressure Israel. And given that the American taxpayer sends Israel more than $5 billion every year and unconditional military and economic aid, the U.S. does have leverage if we chose to chose to provide it. And that doesn't mean abandoning America's historical commitment to Israel's right to exist in peace and security or anything like that. It's just basically saying, we aren't going to give you a blank check if you're going to continue to block peace, if you continue to violate international law, if you're continuing to engage in the very kind of policies that are encouraging Islamic extremists and others who are a threat to your security and in certain ways to ours as well. So what I'm advocating here is something that's actually quite moderate, you know, something that many Israelis have been calling on the United States to do as well. And yet we have, you know, George W. Bush, Hillary Clinton, and all these other people, Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, all going around basically saying it's the Palestinians' fault that that there isn't peace.
There's so many things, more things I'd like to ask, but I've just run out of time, so we'll have to have you back another day. Thank you so much, Professor Stephen Zunes, for joining us today.
Good talking with you. Thank you.
Take care. Again, that was Stephen Zunes. He is the Foreign Policy and Focus Middle East editor and is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and the author of Tenderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism from Common Courage Press. You can check out his website at stephenzunes.org. His last name is spelled Z-U-N-E-S, stephenzunes.org. You can read his articles there and learn more about him and his books and other things. stephenzunes.org.